It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the latest on congressional efforts to reform immigration laws.
First, though, a new effort kicked off this month to break through the partisan divide and government dysfunction in Washington.
It's called Voice of the People. Their website's at VOP.org. The goal is to get everyday Americans on board to overcome divided government and restore faith in public institutions. Stephen Cull is with us. He's a longtime public opinion researcher, political psychologist, and he's the founder and president of Voice of the People. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've got a big idea, and I want to get into that in a minute. But first, I want to outline the problems you're trying to solve. There's no surprise people are losing trust in the American government, but looking at polls, looking at public opinion, how bad is it?
Oh, it's quite bad. The support or the confidence in Congress is at an all-time low, sometimes getting below double digits into the single-digit range. Basically, Americans perceive that government is dominated by special interests, that it is not serving the common good, it's not serving the will of following the will of the people, it's not doing what the people would do. And this domination by the special interests, these interests compete with each other, they get in conflict, we have gridlock, we have the kind of shutdown that we've seen, and people are just very turned off. They don't think this is what the founders had in mind.
And something that might be a little more surprising, I've seen some people say we've got this partisan divide in Congress, and it represents a divide in the public at large. Is that true?
Oh, that's a big myth, and it's something that we've studied extensively, and it's simply not the case. If you look at the American people, they are not. If you look at Congress, you see a cluster way over to the left and a cluster to the right. Overall, if you map them on a left-right spectrum, it's like a U-shaped curve. But the American people, it's not that they're simply centrist. They're just not attached to one side or the other. If you give them arguments on an issue from one side or the other, they see value in both sides of the argument. They're continually trying to find a way to integrate the values from both sides rather than choosing one side and then trying to fight with the other.
So how do we end up, if we're more of a bell curve in the middle, how can we end up with this reverse bell curve in Congress?
Well, that's what the idea that we have is, to try to create a means to give the people a greater voice, to bring them to the table when it comes to the decisions that Congress is making. Now, not everybody has enough information to have to make a really meaningful input into the kinds of decisions that Congress is dealing with. So what we have developed are what we call policy-making simulations, where people are put in the shoes of members of Congress. So they get a briefing on the issue, and then they hear arguments from both sides of the aisle on what needs to happen, strongly stated arguments that have been vetted with and approved by key staffers on both sides. Then they ultimately are presented the issue, and they can make a decision about what they think is best. Often it requires them dealing with trade-offs. For example, in dealing with a budget, needing to deal with revenues as well as spending. If you just take standard polls, they're not really adequate. You say, do you want to balance the budget? A majority says yes. Do you want to raise taxes? A majority says, well, no, not really. Do you want to cut spending in this area, this area, this area? No, not really, because each of those questions are asked separately. In a policymaking simulation, you put people down, you say, okay, here's how the budget is presently distributed, here are the possible sources of revenue, what do you think needs to happen? And when they make up their budget, with a representative sample of the public does very well, much better than Congress. They solve these problems very effectively. They can deal with a Social Security shortfall. So there's a kind of reasonableness in the bulk of American people that can come through and has been demonstrated, and the whole idea is to bring that to the table, bring that common sense of the American people to bear on the decisions that Congress is making.
And that brings us to the big idea. You want us to start a citizens' cabinet to harness that problem-solving ability of the American public. What would that be?
Well, something that we found is this that every member of Congress, to really influence a member of Congress, they really have to hear from their own constituents. So the idea is to have a few hundred in every congressional district. That means about 120,000 nationwide. So these people will be scientifically selected to be representative of the people in each district. If they don't have internet access, they're given internet access so that they can go online and go through these policymaking simulations that we're talking about. Then every member of Congress then can hear from their people. So the idea is that we'll create a national academy for public consultation that will set up the citizen cabinet and really give the people a voice so that every member can hear from their people, the senators as well as House members.
So one response might be, well, if I'm an interested, concerned citizen, I could right now go out and do a little research and then call my congressional representative, my senator. Why isn't that enough?
Yeah, well, those are great things to do. But one of the problems these days is that people really don't always know where to look, and wherever they go, it's often very biased. So what this does is it creates a situation where you get an objective presentation of the issue, and then you hear both biases in both directions, like in a debate or something like that. So then you really hear something that's comprehensive. Then you give your input, and you give it in a way that's very structured so that it's aimed at the choice points that members of Congress are dealing with, so that the input you're giving is really totally relevant to the decisions that they're currently making.
On a practical level, I mean, who would be in charge of organizing this big deal?
Well, the idea in creating the National Academy for Public Consultation is that you would have a bipartisan oversight board with some former members of Congress, some academics, some business leaders, and half of the oversight board would be a small, randomly selected sample of the American people once again. So you've got that, common sense sensibility at the table. But it wouldn't be dominated by either party. And again, the process that people go through would be approved by people on both sides of the aisle.
What kind of support are you getting for this so far?
Well, we have had quite a few meetings on the Hill now, about 60 meetings on the Hill, and we're getting quite a positive response. You know, people think that members of Congress like it being the way it is, but they really don't. They're frustrated as well, and so they find this a very refreshing idea, and we have gotten support. There's talk about legislation, and we have had some step forward and say that they'll be at least a co-sponsor of the legislation. It's moving along. We've created this organization to sign people up so that when there is a bill, that they'll be ready to step forward and express support for it. And I'm hoping that people will do that. We'll go to the VOP.org and sign the petition in favor of this idea, and then be ready there so that we can really get the mobilize that support when the time comes.
So suppose this does happen, and in a few years, whatever time frame, I get a phone call at home saying, Rob, we want you to be a representative of this citizens' cabinet in your congressional district.
Right.
What happens? What do I do then?
Well, the idea is that people will be part of it for 9 to 12 months, and that they agree to go through these policymaking simulations every few weeks or so. If you don't have internet access already, it's given to you so that it's truly a representative sample. It's important that you don't tell other people, you know, or don't broadcast it, because we don't want special interests coming around and trying to influence you. It's kind of like a grand jury, so it's supposed to be confidential. But you go through this in-depth process and get educated and weigh in.
Well, you've got people curious. We've got full phone lines. We haven't given the number yet. I'm going to go to Garrett in Milwaukee. Garrett, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just had a quick question about how you're going to select the members. You mentioned that they're going to be scientifically selected to be representative of the public.
Right.
How do you plan on doing that without making assumptions about how the views are distributed in the public?
Sure. This is the same method that you use in any survey or poll or anything like that. The core of it is that you randomly select people, and you do that, you know, district by district. Then you take that group and you say, okay, are they different from what the census says? And usually they're very close to the census just through random sampling. But to the extent that there's any variation, then you apply weights so that it is an exact microcosm of the public.
But we're talking to Stephen Cull. He's founder and president of Voice of the People. This is an effort to set up advisory citizens' cabinets in each congressional district. The people get information about top issues, information from both sides if it's a two-sided issue. The idea is it'll help break through gridlock and the partisan divide.
So what do you think about the idea? Do you think it could actually help change anything? Would you like to serve on a citizens' cabinet? Or do you have questions about whether this could actually work? If you'd like, give us a call at 800-642-1234 to weigh in, or you can email us. That address is talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here filling in for Veronica Rickert.
We continue our conversation now with Stephen Cull. He's founder and president of Voice of the People. It's this effort to start a citizens' cabinet, having people in each congressional district offering advice to elected officials on key issues. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions about how this works at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Connor with us in Appleton. Connor, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess the first thought I had, and Stephen touched on this with special interest, lobbyists was the first thing that popped into my head. This idea is fantastic. I'd love to be involved in one of these groups, if possible, but my how is this going to work in terms of advising politicians, policymakers, where you're giving free advice as opposed to advice with lots of perks, we'll just say. I mean, how do you think, Stephen, that will be navigated, I guess?
Well, what will really be key is that I think local media, we're really quite sure that local media will pick this up in a big way. Local media is always looking for a local story, and we will be giving them data about how people in their region feel about these issues. So this will be publicized, and there'll be a lot of interest too in how the member is voting and whether this is consistent with what people are saying. And so suddenly there will be this reference point. Well, there are all kinds of people who make the assertion that they're representing the people, and people who are saying contradictory things, so they can't all be right. For the first time, we will really know what the people are saying, and we will be able to know if a member is in line with the people. Now, that we're not saying that a member should always do exactly what the people say in some kind of mechanical way. If they want to stand up and say, no, here's why I'm doing this, why I'm voting this way, here are my reasons, great. People respect that. But if they're also taking money from a special interest, then people are going to say, well, let me think now. Is that really why you're doing this, if you're actually supporting a special interest? So it'll shine a bright light on it, and it will really be a new way to ask the question, is your member being guided by a special interest here or being guided by the sense of the people?
Thanks for the call, Connor. We'll go to Guy in West Allis now. Guy, you're on the air.
So my question is kind of following the same line, is if you have the grouping of people, if you have too many business people in there, they're going to always have a business perspective, which is, well, traditionally Republican. If you have too many union people in the grouping, then it's going to have more of a Democratic point of view. How are you going to make sure that they're not influenced by their churches or by their stuff, that they're actually doing it by the issues and not by everything bombarding them?
Yeah, well, the whole idea is to create a real microcosm. So as I was saying earlier, we would use the census to compare the sample to make sure that it's representative. And this is representative in terms of income, in terms of age, in terms of education, so that it's truly representative. So you're not going to have a disproportionate element that's in the business community or any particular faction. You know, the methods for developing representative samples have been well developed and have been proven to be quite effective. These will be applied.
Would, if I'm on one of these citizen cabinets, would I be a subject for persuasion by an interest, a union, a business, a group?
What's key here is that just like a grand jury, it would be confidential who you are, so it wouldn't be possible to try to get to these people. And I'll also remember that there would be over 100,000 of them, and they would be constantly being changed every quarter or so. A quarter of them would be changed out, so there'd be this constant turnover. But the when you join the cabinet, you're asked to agree that if anybody tries to influence you or contact you, you would let us know, and then. And that would be stopped, because the whole idea is to really get people to look at this thing, the issues in a very common and objective way, and to hear strongly stated arguments, but from all sides, so that you have a real balanced perspective in the end.
Thanks, Guy. We have Roger in Madison now. Roger, hi.
Hi. I'm kind of puzzled about how this will really work, because it seems to me, since you're using congressional district boundaries, the congressional district boundaries are gerrymandered. They're redistricted with a large bias in many states right now. A few states Democrat, many more Republican, and if you're going to use those same boundaries to do this, it seems to me you're going to be stuck with the same biases that our dear political parties have managed to build into their redistricting.
Gotcha. Stephen?
Right. Well, you'll be doing, of course, states as well as districts, and states are not gerrymandered, just the House ones. But when it comes to the issues, it turns out, to a surprising extent, that Republicans and Democrats are not all that. When people really get into the issue and when they really hear all the arguments this way and that way, it turns out that they're not so sharply different. So I think you'll be surprised when these numbers come out that they're not people do align with their parties when they vote. But when they look at the issues, they're not as different as the parties are. The people are more similar than the parties.
Time for one more call from Monica in Greenfield. Monica, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I think it's a great idea. I think it's going to probably be hard to implement because of, you know, legalities or technicalities. But I love the idea. I think that would be a great way for us, the people, to start really deciding what we want to do, and then tell those elected officials, you need to do what we want you to do and solve these problems, and your election is going to depend on your record at doing what we want you to do, instead of having to vote on how well you speak or how charismatic you are or how likable you are. And I think that's great.
All right, yeah, Monica, thanks.
And, you know, one thing to really emphasize, too, here is that the processes that people on the citizen cabinet will be going through won't just be for them. It'll be put online so that anybody and everybody can go and go through that process themselves, get informed, get educated, and then they can communicate more effectively to their member of Congress. So we're envisioning that many people will be using these tools to more effectively participate.
We've talked a lot about the practicalities. Can you spend our last minute plus talking about the political philosophy that underlies what you're trying to do here?
Well, it really goes back to the founders. Their vision was that what you need to do is give that policymakers should be thinking about only two things. Alexander Hamilton said they should be thinking about the common good and what they called the sense of the people. And that this sense of the people, what they said, to get to the sense of the people, you need to have a calm and deliberative process where people can really think things through. And that sensibility that comes out in that reflective deliberative process, that really should guide policymakers. And we're trying to create a space for that. Right now, so much of the political process tries to work people up into this passionate state of mind that the founder said, no, that's not what should govern. And they didn't think, too, that, well, if you have these people over here and these people over there, and they fight, you know, and there's, you know, conflict, and then whatever the outcome, well, that somehow represents the people. No, they said that's a really bad idea. What we want is this common deliberative sense of the people, so that the underlying values and priorities of the people emerge. And it does turn out, and because we've been working on these kinds of processes for some time, that when you take people through these processes, they do find common ground. That the similarities, the differences between Republicans and Democrats tends to diminish as they hear both sides of the issue and as they have to deal with the trade-offs when they finally make their policy recommendations.
All right, Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Stephen Kull, founder and president of Voice of the People. We have a link to a piece he wrote on the Central Time Facebook page.
And coming up, a look at the immigration reform debate. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll be taking a look at the life of a Wisconsin legend, Harry Houdini.
First, though, Congress made some moves on immigration this week, with three House Republicans coming out in support of the Democratic Immigration Reform Bill.
Now, the Democrats are still a ways away from a majority for the proposed legislation, but this could put pressure on legislators to move forward with the debate. That debate, by the way, was put on the back burner during the government's fiscal standstill.
Here to update us on immigration reform is USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So first, let's talk about the Republicans this week. Who signed on and said they would support this wider immigration reform bill?
Well, in the past week, we've had three Republicans, Ileana Ross-Layton from Florida, Jeff Denham from California, he was the first one, and the most recent has been Representative David Valadao from California. Now, these are all Republicans who come from districts that have a lot of immigrants, that come from predominantly Hispanic districts, so for them, you know, as Valadao put it, he's like, I come from an immigrant family. I grew up in an immigrant community. You know, it's not a stretch for me. But at the same time, it's also very important that they've picked up some of these Republican co-sponsors. The Democrats at first, when they filed this bill, a lot of people thought it was just a political ploy to try to get the House leadership to get moving on immigration. But now that they're starting to pick up some of these Republican co-sponsors, some folks are starting to say, hey, maybe this thing has some legs in the House.
Well, let's get into this thing. What kind of key measures does it include?
Well, it's an interesting approach that they've taken. Basically, they took a version of the bill that was passed in the Senate earlier this year. And to catch you up, basically back in June, the Senate passed a comprehensive immigration bill that would provide a pathway to citizenship for the nation's 12 million undocumented immigrants. It would add $46 billion to securing the Southwest border, and it would completely revamp the legal immigration system so that they can bring in more high-tech workers, more low-skilled workers, and do things like that. What this Democratic bill does is it basically takes that Senate bill and cuts out the border security portion. They think it's overkill. They think it's too many Border Patrol agents. They don't think it's needed. And they replaced it with a border security plan that was actually developed by a House Republican and has at least passed a House committee so far. And what that does is pretty much it dictates that we have to start measuring the border and have a smarter, more effective strategy to stop illegal immigration from coming across. So they've taken a sort of hybrid, as they're calling it, they're trying to call it a bipartisan bill. And now that they've picked up these three Republicans, and I know they're trying for it to get a few more, they're definitely saying that it's becoming a bipartisan bill that should get some consideration in the House.
But the bulk of the Republican Party in the House isn't going for this kind of comprehensive plan, right? Are they going for more of a piecemeal approach?
Exactly. I mean, what the Democrats in the House want and what House Republican leaders want is very, very different. And basically what you've had so far in the House is they've cut up the immigration issue into little slices. So they've been considering so far about a handful of bills that deal with specific portions. For example, that border security component that I talked about a moment ago. There's a bill that increases the number of high-tech visas for workers to come into the country. There's another bill that deals with interior enforcement that would allow local and state police officers to enforce immigration laws, similar to what we've seen in Arizona and Alabama, things like that. And so they're going bit by bit. They haven't even really filed a bill that deals with the 12 million undocumented immigrants in the country and how to handle them. So, you know, when you start seeing that the Senate has already passed their bill and then the House is taking this very slow, methodical, piece-by-piece approach, this is all an effort by Democrats to try to get them to hurry things up a little bit.
And this week, there's been some pressure from conservatives around the country making the case for a bigger picture immigration reform. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think these guys, they don't care if it's a big bill, if it's a small bill. They just want to see something get done. And so what you saw was on Tuesday, there's over 600 conservatives came in from around the country representing a wide cross-section of interests. You had pastors who were coming up. You had business owners who were coming saying they can't get the workers they need. You had farmers. You had law enforcement agencies. You had police chiefs, sheriffs coming in. To make the argument that legalizing the nation's undocumented immigrants would actually help in the long term. And so it was that's sort of a coalition that's been building up over the last, say, year and a half, where before it used to be just kind of the more traditional immigration advocates that were pushing Congress to get some sort of reform passed. This has been a relatively new attempt by these folks to get in here and really use these conservative voices who they think can speak a little more directly and a little more clearly to these Republican members of the House. I mean, it's a lot easier to say no to somebody who's just a traditional immigration advocate than it is your pastor. So that's the approach that they've been taking, and there were 600 of them here on Tuesday. They met with, I think it was over 100 members of the House, of Republicans in the House. And, you know, in talking to them afterwards, you know, it doesn't sound like, you know, there is a wave of Republicans who are all of a sudden swayed by this. But definitely that pressure, they're maintaining that pressure on those Republicans.
Well, with the few Republicans we talked about earlier in the House signing into this Democratic bill, supporters of comprehensive immigration reform have been drawing attention to that, but they're still well short of enough votes to pass it. Is there a sense that there might be, you know, more dominoes to fall, more Republicans stepping forward after this pressure?
I mean, that's what they're hoping for. I've been reaching out to a lot of the Republicans who are sort of on the fence, the ones who either come from heavily immigrant communities, who have interests in their districts like that require a lot of immigrant labor. And, you know, I got to tell you, it's been I've been getting an interesting series of responses. Some of them are just saying flat out no, but there's a lot of them who are saying that they're taking time to read the bill, they're looking through it, that it's a possibility. So they're hoping to get. They've already got about 186 Democrats. They've picked up these three Republicans, and when you realize that you just got to reach 218 votes to pass something through the House, what they're hoping for is that they can get enough, or at least get close enough, to pressure the House to bring this thing up for a vote. Generally speaking, the House Republican leadership has abided by something they refer to as the Hastert rule, meaning that the majority of Republicans have to support something before they would bring it to the floor. They've broken from that a couple of times in the past year, most recently on the vote to end the government shutdown. It was a lot of Democrats and some Republicans that were able to pass that bill through the House. So they're calling on the House leadership to do just that. But at the same time, on an issue like this, I can tell you that there's been zero response from House leaders on this Democratic bill. They say that they like the approach they're taking, that bill-by-bill approach. So it's still going to be incredibly difficult to get this thing to the floor. But like I said before, they're hoping that at least the pressure gets them to that point.
Did the government shutdown slow down consideration of either course on immigration reform?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, ever since the Senate passed their immigration bill, that was back in June, and it was a strange moment here in D.C. It was a bipartisan bill. They got it all together. They went through a series of committee hearings, and it got passed on the Senate floor. You know, that's the kind of work that we haven't seen a lot out of Congress, and so there was this momentum, this enthusiasm, and then it just completely hit the brakes in the House. And it's been not just their strategy, but you know, not long afterwards, you know, we had Syria going crazy. So that was a few weeks that everybody was tied up with that. And then the government shut down. I mean, that was, yeah, that was as I'd be walking around the Capitol trying to talk to people about immigration, and they're kind of looking me in the face like, you realize the government shut down, right? This is not the time to be talking about this. So, yeah, those issues absolutely ate up time in the chamber. But, you know, they've got, I think it's at least 3 weeks left of legislative time this year. It could stretch into early next year. There's already some discussion about maybe that window after the primaries and before the election, that might be a time where they can kind of get back into this. But, yeah, when these other issues kind of take precedence, it's hard to really get into the immigration debate.
I've seen a lot of newspaper stories start over the years, and I've said it a few times on the air. It looks like immigration reform might be just around the corner. Is it really just around the corner this time, or is this just another sort of time?
I mean, I feel like and you're absolutely right. It's since the beginning of this year, it's felt like that. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, the fact that the Senate was able to pass that bill, that was something pretty remarkable, bringing together as many Republicans as they did to get that through. You know, that is definitely the furthest that chamber has gone in many, many, many years. But like everything else with this House, it's going to be tough to get that through. I mean, I've been joking around for the last kind of 6 months or so, I've been putting it at about 20% likelihood of something like that getting through. And, you know, I'd say that's still a pretty fair assessment. They've got a bunch of bills teed up, ready to go. They could bring them to the floor at any moment. So if something happens, it could happen pretty quickly. But again, these guys, the Republicans in the House especially, came out of that shutdown fight very, very suspicious of dealing and negotiating with Senate Democrats and with the White House. So they are absolutely paranoid about passing something in the House, and then it goes to a conference committee with the Senate, and then who knows what comes out of that. So it's still a long shot. It's still going to be very difficult to get through, but you know, this is probably the closest they've come in a very long time.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
That's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today.
Right now, we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with the life of Wisconsin legend Harry Houdini. This is Central Time.
In addition to being Halloween, October 31st is also the anniversary of the strange death of a Wisconsin legend, Harry Houdini.
That's right. Matthew Carpenter is very well aware of that connection between Halloween and Houdini. He is the executive director of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton, which has an ongoing Houdini exhibit. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, Gene. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to start out with the Wisconsin connection, you know, because I read some biographies, real brief ones of Houdini in preparation for this. And there was one that says he was born in Hungary and then they moved to Milwaukee. Another one says he was born in Appleton. What is the Wisconsin connection?
Yeah, there's some confusion there. And in part, it's because Houdini created that confusion. He did that with a lot of things. Houdini, it's pretty well understood now that Houdini was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1874, and the family immigrated to Appleton when Houdini was 4 years old. At that time, his father, Rabbi Weiss, took a job with the local Reformed Jewish congregation in Appleton, so he became the first resident rabbi here in Appleton. And the family really only lived here in Appleton for 4 short years. His father was fired from the congregation, and then they moved on to Milwaukee and then later to New York. But those 4 years in Appleton were very important to young Eric Weiss, later Harry Houdini, really made an impression on him. And in his heart, Appleton was his hometown. So he kind of blurred the lines at various times. Sometimes he was a European sensation, and other times he was an American appearing in Europe.
And you said that he added to the confusion, and one of the things he did was he claimed to have been born in Appleton, right?
Right, right. And it's clearly not the case. I mean, the historians have documented the immigration records. He came across on a ship that landed in New York, and all of that's pretty well documented.
So let's talk about after he left Appleton in Milwaukee, moves to New York, and I think a lot of folks are familiar with kind of the arc of his career. He became famous as a magician, and then later went on to become famous in some other things too. But could we talk about kind of the context of just how famous he was? I mean, 80 some years after his death, we're still talking about him, and that says something.
It really does. Yeah, that's, I think, a very important point. This guy was, people say he was the highest paid performer of his day. Certainly that was true in his vaudeville career. So he was a superstar of his time, and kind of like some of the superstars today, it was part his talent for performance, but in part it was his ability to read his audience and to continually reinvent himself and look for new ways to stay on that cutting edge of a changing world. So he was constantly reinventing himself to remain relevant. And as you say, you know, what is it, 87 years or so later, we're still talking about him. His name is in the dictionary. He's to some degree a household name, although, as you've pointed out, there's a lot of misinformation and confusion about the details of his life.
And let's start out talking about kind of the earlier part of his career. I want to get into some of the spiritualism stuff that he dealt with in the 1920s. But what most people think of Houdini, they think of him as escaping from, you know, water torture cells and manacles and handcuffs and all those things. And that was a big deal at the time, this whole idea of escaping from things. Houdini sort of lifted that to a whole new level where his name became synonymous with that sort of thing.
Yeah, he did. I think at the time, magic historians talk about sort of the stereotypical gentleman in a tuxedo or dresswear, politely performing magic on a stage. Houdini certainly wore that tuxedo, but he also stripped down to a loincloth and performed nearly nude.
Pretty racy stuff for
racy stuff. Yeah. So, he broke the stereotype, and he created a whole new genre of whether you call it magic or escape performance.
And one of the other things he did was he was a magician. He did all of these tricks, but at the same time, he was very interested in sort of fraud, and he was interested in explaining how some of these tricks were done.
Yeah, he, this organization has been criticized for exposing some of Houdini's tricks in an exhibit that we opened in 2004. But it's pretty ironic because Houdini himself, as you say, he was writing books and articles. In fact, I think it was a 1914 Ladies' Home Journal article.
I remember that one.
Mass market as you can get, right? So he's explaining how to escape from handcuffs and ropes, and he went on to write a number of books that on some level divulged the secrets of the trade. He was always pretty careful to walk a line where, you know, maybe he would divulge the secrets of something his competitors were doing, but he'd protect some of the details of his own work. But definitely, he was sort of surgically using those exposés or those insights into the performance art to further his own career.
And then later on, of course, there was that spiritualism craze in the U.S. in the 1920s with Ouija boards and interest in fairies and all of that. And he was very interested in exposing that. And he was not a believer. And he offered money, as I recall, you know, for anybody who could prove that it existed. And that was something he was deeply interested in.
Yeah. The spiritualist craze began in the mid part of the 19th century. And the funny thing is, again, it's an irony that at the start of Houdini's career, before he actually made it, he and his wife Bess were both performing as mediums or essentially fraudulent spiritualists. So they were taking people's money to help those people connect with their dead loved ones. Well, Cut forward, you know, a couple of decades. By that time, Houdini has certainly matured, and he's not as desperate to earn a living. But he's also experienced a very profound and painful loss of his beloved mother. And so I think there was a desire to maintain the connection to his mother that I suspect sparked his interest in spiritualism. But he ultimately had a feeling that it wasn't possible. He never quite let go of the idea of it, but he really felt strongly that people who were benefiting from other people's grief in essentially exploiting people's grief by claiming to be able to speak to their dead loved ones were not people who should be tolerated. And yeah, he worked through the Scientific and American, that organization and that journal, to make a challenge to mediums and say, if you can prove that you have supernatural abilities, if you can speak to the dead, that we'll give you this prize. And no one was ever able to successfully prove that was possible. No one ever claimed the prize. He also became a social activist, and in Washington, D.C., he worked very hard to create laws that prohibited fraudulent mediums from operating. He would go to such lengths as to dress in disguise and infiltrate the parlors of the various mediums of the day and expose them in front of audiences. So,
well, and I'm afraid we have to wrap it up here, Matt. But Houdini died on October 31st, 1926, and he never did come back from the other side.
He didn't.
Matthew Carpenter is the executive director of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton.